Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning and welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast and listen later at your leisure. It's Saturday the 4th of January 2025, just in case you're listening on catch up. So happy new year.
Yes, happy
another
new year.
52 weeks of this Life Science Show. Hurrah. You've got Julian Paul here live as usual. Later in the show we'll be talking to RPG. There's no Phil this week. It should be Phil Muffet from the Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society. He's had a better offer, can you believe? He's got a powerboat course going on. Because he's a member of the Manvers Waterfront Boat Club. If you want to check that out, it's www.mwbc.org.uk. Great place. If you want to start the new year and do something new, join up. All good stuff. And also check out Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society's website, www.msas.org.uk. All good stuff. They're going from strength to strength. They've got an observatory up at Huber Stand. I know they had an event last Saturday afternoon into the evening, where if you got a telescope for Christmas or a pair of binoculars, or you've got one in that, you had one in the house that you really didn't know how to use and you just did it off. I think they had 30 odd people turn up and they set up binoculars for them and everything. It's all really, really cool stuff. So hope Phil will be back with us soon. All being well, next week we should have Dr. Ogo Osamo on the line. We'll see. Before that, let's see. A reminder of an event happening at the end of this month.
Yes, this is the RSPB Big Garden Birdwatch, Friday 24th to the Sunday 26th of January. So take part in the UK's biggest garden wildlife survey by watching the birds for an hour between 24th and the 26th of January. Last year, more than 600,000 people participated in the RSPB organised event. Grab a cuppa and record the birds you see in your garden from your balcony or in a local park, and then log them on the RSPB website, which is rspb.org.uk/birdwatch.
All good stuff. Now then, next up, a brief look back at 2024. Quite a few things I just want to cover here. The first one, Professor Sir Adrian Hill. While his won plaudits include a knighthood for helping produce the Oxford AstraZeneca COVID vaccine, Professor Hill has been working on a vaccine for malaria since 1994. This year, or should I say last year, in 2024, the R21 Matrix M jab, which cost less than £3 a dose, was sent to 15 African countries. Scientists hope that it could pave the way for the eradication of malaria within the decade. Malaria kills more than 600,000 people a year, 95% of them in Africa, and 80% of them under the age of five. For the first time, really, in the last couple of years, eradication is beginning to look really credible, said Professor Hill. He's 65 years old. He says, I think the whole thing is doable, not in the next 5 years, but maybe in the next 10 years. So that's Professor Adrian Hill with the Matrix M jab. Costs less than £3 a dose to try and tackle malaria. The next interesting story of last year, a teenager from Somerset with severe epilepsy became the first person in the world to be fitted with a brain implant to control seizures. Oran Nolson, 13, had the device fitted as part of a trial at Great Ormond Street Hospital, and since the age of three, he's suffered hundreds of seizures a day. The signals from this implant have reduced these attacks by up to 80%. All good stuff. Similarly health-based, a new treatment for asthma attacks is being hailed as the first breakthrough in 50 years and a potential game-changer for sufferers. Trials of the drug benralizumab, I hope I've said that correctly, it's spelled B-E-N-R-A-L-I-Z-U-M-A-B. It's been trialled at King's College London. And research published last month found it to be more effective than steroid tablets, the current preferred method. The drug targets specific white blood cells to reduce inflammation, as found to reduce the need for further treatment by 30%. I'll try and say that name again. It's an asthma drug. It's called benralizumab. Ooh, difficult. Another interesting story, top banana. Scientists from Northumbria University in the UK and the National Textile University in Pakistan have found a way to convert banana waste into clothes and energy. New technology developed in Pakistan will transform banana waste into textile fibres, and the waste generated from this process will be used to produce renewable energy. Currently, 50% of people living in rural areas of the country rely on fossil fuels for energy. Researchers believe the process could be applied to almost any form of agricultural waste anywhere in the world. All good stuff. Another very interesting story from last year, soluble plastic. A durable, environmentally friendly type of plastic that fully dissolves in seawater has been developed by scientists at the Riken Institute in Japan. When placed in salt water, it breaks down within hours and generates no harmful microplastics, which have been polluting the seas and the soil for decades. And it stops them finding their way into the food chain. So the new plastic also degrades completely in soil over a 10-day period, releasing a chemical similar to fertilizer. And finally, a very interesting one. If you tuned in last week for the last show of the year, Chris Dale was in the studio with us. He was talking about ultra-processed foods, but in particular about sugar, the impact on your health and your teeth. So last year, the sugar tax was actually introduced by the government in 2018, but it significantly reduced the amount of sugar eaten and drunk by children in the UK since that point. The levy was for manufacturers of soft drinks with more than 5 grams of sugar per 100 millilitres, which is a lot. It's a teaspoon of sugar, that, per 100 mils. In the year after it was imposed, children consumed 4.8 grams less sugar every day, of which 3 grams was attributed to the reduced sugar content of soft drinks. Adults consumed 10.9 grams less sugar a day overall.
I know that this is the day.
Great track there. I'm Hungry by the Sugar Cubes, which is Bjork, of course,
yes.
In a real sort of rocky band. And we talked about that because we're looking briefly back on 2024. And in particular, the last item we talked about was the impact of the sugar tax. And talking of sugar, Ozempic's no cure for unhealthy food, says Joe Wicks. So Ozempic is this new weight loss drug, which I read incredibly more and more about. It's quite worrying from my point of view, I think. But here we go.
Sorry, yes, I was busy doing something.
He's distracted.
Yeah. Right, Ozempic's no cure for unhealthy food, says Joe Wicks. Joe Wicks has questioned the benefits of shedding pounds using Ozempic, a diabetes drug, with a reputation as the skinny jab thanks to its weight loss side effects. It's taken the world by storm, hasn't it? But you've got to address the underlying issues around food. Is it a psychological thing? Do you comfort eat? Are you exercising or active? Because just losing weight's okay, but actually, are you healthy? And that takes more than a jab, the fitness influencer told the Daily Telegraph. Demand for Ozempic, a prescribed medication for type 2 diabetes, surged after it hit the headlines for being Hollywood's secret weight loss drug. It works by lowering blood sugar levels and slowing down food leaving the stomach, meaning users want to eat less. Its popularity has led to global supply issues and a shortage for UK diabetes patients.
Yeah, all very interesting. So Joe Wicks, 39, has spent recent years, really trying to spread the benefits of fitness and healthy eating. And as well as his online workouts, he's written a series of cookbooks for healthy meals. Growing up, though, he ate very differently. My diet was crisps, wagon wheels, Sunny Delight, chicken nuggets. That's all I knew as a kid, he said. But he believes that rather than seek quick fixes, people should reassess their relationship with food, even if they exercise regularly. It's affecting everybody, whether you're on a high salary or low salary, he said. We're now seeing it's really affecting the brain and the gut more than we think. We can't just exercise it off. Something needs to change from not just the government, but the food companies. The food they're producing, can it be healthier at a cheaper price? Joe Wicks also praised Jamie Oliver, the celebrity chef who's worked to educate the public on healthy eating. Right there from Beth Blade and the Beautiful Disasters, Sin Eater. We played that because we're talking about Ozempic's no cure for unhealthy food, says Joe Wicks. Oh, and it's no excuse for not exercising either. If you've just tuned in, of course, you listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital. If you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. every week. We've got no guest speaker this week, but all being well, Dr. Ogo Osimo should be with us next week. And we do hope, Phil, that you're having great fun on your powerboat course. We're very jealous. Next up, Weather Eye.
Yes, December has the shortest hours of daylight and the longest night, so why doesn't it usually have the coldest weather? The winter solstice was on December 21 this year, last year, but the coldest weather trends tends to come a month or two afterwards, even though the daylight hours grow longer in January and February. That delay follows the slow seasonal shifts in the seas, which take a long time to warm up in the heat of summer, often only reaching a peak in early September. After that, they gradually release their store-up warmth in late autumn and winter, cooling down in January and February, and often reaching their coldest in early March. The closer a location is to the sea, the milder the climate tends to be. For a maritime nation such as Britain, the climate is typically mild in winter, compared with the more extreme cold far inland in continental Europe. Added to that, the ocean currents from the Gulf Stream and its offshoots help to keep the UK and Northwest Europe warmer than the equivalent maritime latitudes in Canada.
All exciting stuff. And the seasonal lag in weather also means the summer solstice in June is rarely the warmest time of year, because the ground and seas are cold from winter and it takes time to warm up under the longer and stronger hours of summer sunshine. In fact, it takes four times as much energy to raise the temperature of water by 1 degree Celsius as it does for rocks. And so July or August tend to be the warmest months of the year, although Britain tends to have milder summers than the more extreme heat typical of inland continental Europe. There are exceptions to this rule of thumb, however, and the extreme freeze of December 2010, remember it well, because we only just got to Kenya and we avoided it for 2 weeks, came back and couldn't believe it that everybody had been snowed in for 2 weeks. When the country was frozen in a Siberian blast of sub-zero temperatures, deep snow and hard frost, for example. And that extreme cold was thanks to a huge upheaval in the stratosphere that blocked our usual mild Atlantic winds and swept in bitterly cold winds from Siberia. So that's a bit of a weather eye for you. Piece of music there, About the Weather by Magazine. Whoa, yeah. 1981, it's really interesting track that we've played it a few times, actually. Just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're here every Saturday morning, 11 till 12, live in the studio here on Paternoster Row, talking about science in all its different forms. The next one's a really interesting one that popped up on the BBC website the other day, and it said, twig stats. New DNA bone testing could rewrite British history. And if you're into history, you'll find this fascinating. So, from the end of the Roman occupation through the Anglo-Saxon and Viking invasions, a new way of testing DNA or deoxyribonucleic acid in full in ancient bones could force a rethink of key moments in Britain's early history, according to researchers. Scientists can already track big alterations in DNA that occur over thousands or millions of years, but now researchers can identify subtler, smaller changes over just hundreds of years, providing clues as to how people migrated and interacted with locals. They're using the new method to analyse human remains found in Britain, including from the time when Romans were replaced by an Anglo-Saxon elite from Europe. Now, Professor Peter Heather from King's College London, who is working on the project with the developers of the new DNA technique at the Francis Crick Institute in London, said the new technique could be revolutionary. While the project will analyse the DNA of more than 1,000 ancient human remains of people who have lived in Britain during the past 4,500 years, researchers have homed in on the time after the Romans left as a particularly interesting era to study. What happened in this period more than 1,500 years ago is unclear from written and archaeological records. Historians are divided in their views about the scale and nature of the Anglo-Saxon invasion around that time, whether it was large or small, hostile or cooperative.
The project team are optimistic about the success of the technique known as TwigStats. That's TwigStats. After testing it on human remains found in mainland Europe and finding that much of what they gleaned from the DNA about the spread of the Vikings into Scandinavia tallied with historical records, this result, published in the journal Nature, confirmed the method worked while showing how powerful it could be at shedding new light on accepted facts when findings didn't match what was written in the history books. The problem the researchers were trying to overcome is that a human's genetic code is extremely long, consisting of 3 billion separate chemical units. Whew. Spotting the small genetic changes in that code, which occur over a few generations, for example, as a result of new arrivals interbreeding with the local population, is like looking for a needle in a haystack.
Indeed. So the researchers solved the problem by, as it were, taking away the haystack and leaving the needle in plain sight. The researchers found a way to identify the older genetic changes, disregard them, and look only at the most recent alterations. They combed the genetic data of thousands of human remains from an online scientific database, then calculated how closely they were related to each other, which chunks of DNA were inherited from which groups and when. This created a family tree, get this, with older changes appearing in the earlier branches and the more recent changes showing up in newer twigs, hence the name TwigStats.
Yes.
So, you know, that's going to be a word you're going to hear probably more and more moving forward. So the technique can potentially be applied to any part of the world for which there are a large collection of well-preserved human remains. And if that sounds right up your street, if you've been watching the series for Digging for Britain with Professor Alice Roberts, it's absolutely fascinating stuff. There's a new series, apparently, featuring one of the Anglo-Saxon burial sites, Poulton Farm, and you'll be available to watch it on BBC iPlayer from the 7th of January this year. We're currently trying to find it on just normal TV, yes. But it's going to, well, it's a bit of a game changer, isn't it?
Let's get down to it, boppers. Hey!
Monday, MC. We did Renegade Soundwave and AC, DC.
Interesting track again there, Can You Dig It by Pop Eats Itself, because we're talking about Twig Stats. The new DNA bone testing could rewrite British history. Watch this space. You're of course listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. RPG will be with us soon, but before that, the other week he was talking about Portland Cement at the end of last year, and he was talking about that with reference to the construction of London sewers way back in Victorian times. So I thought I'd just remind us what Portland Cement is. And it's quite local, actually. Portland Cement is the most common type of cement in general use around the world as a basic ingredient of concrete, mortar, stucco and non-speciality grout. The low cost and widespread availability of the limestone, shale and other naturally occurring materials used in Portland Cement make it one of the lowest cost materials widely used over the last century. And concrete produced from Portland Cement is one of the world's most versatile construction materials. But actually, did you know that Portland Cement was developed in the early 19th century by Joseph Aspin, a bricklayer, can you believe, living in the Hunslet district of Leeds, no less. By 1817, Joseph Aspin had set up a business on his own in central Leeds and started experimenting with cement manufacture. Eventually, on the 21st of October 1824, he was granted the British patent BP5022, entitled An Improvement in the Mode of Producing an Artificial Stone, in which he used the term Portland cement because set mortar made from his product looked like the best Portland stone, which is a type of limestone that is quarried on the Isle of Portland in Dorset, which at the time was the most prestigious building stone in use in England at that time. So after obtaining the British patent for Portland cement in 1824, Joseph Aston went into partnership with a Leeds neighbour called William Beverley, and in 1825 set up a production plant for Portland cement based in Kirkgate in Wakefield. Interesting. So Portland cement is basically a fine powder produced by heating limestone and clay minerals in a kiln to form a substance known as clinker, and then grinding the clinker and adding 2 to 3% of gypsum. So several types of Portland cement are available. The most common, which is called ordinary Portland cement or OPC, is grey, but white Portland cement is also available. And interestingly, although Portland cement was named by Joseph Aston, who obtained a patent for it in 1824, it's actually son William Aston is regarded as the inventor of modern Portland cement due to the developments he made in the 1840s. So his son William's innovation was to mix make a mix with a higher limestone content, to burn it at a higher temperature using more fuel, and to grind the resulting clinker in such a way that it increased wear and tear in the grinding process. However, William Astin did not actually file for a new patent on his modified process and sometimes claimed his father's original patent for the product as his own. Nonetheless, William is still credited with launching the modern Portland cement industry rather than his father. Now, Portland cement is caustic, meaning it can cause chemical burns and skin irritation, or with severe exposure, lung cancer. It can also contain a number of hazardous substances, including crystalline silica and hexavalent chromium, whatever they are. Anyway, environmental concerns are the high energy consumption required to mine, manufacture and transport the Portland cement, and the related air pollution, including the release of CO2 or carbon dioxide gas, nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide and fine particulate matter dust particles.
You to me are sweet as roses in the morning, and you to me are soft as summer rain at dawn in lovely shade. That's something rare. The sidewalks in the street, the concrete and the clay beneath my feet begins to crumble. But love will never die, because we'll see the mountains tumble before we say goodbye. My love and I will be in love eternally. That's the way, that's the way it's meant to be. All around I see the purple shades of evening, and on the ground shadows fall, and once again you're in my arms so tenderly. The sidewalks in the street, the concrete and the clay beneath my feet begins to crumble. But love will never die, because we'll see the mountains crumble before we say goodbye. My love and I will be in love eternally. And that's the way, that's the way it's meant to be. Sidewalks in the street, the concrete and the clay beneath my feet begins to crumble. But love will never die, because we'll see the mountains tumble before we say goodbye. My love and I will be in love eternally.
Very interesting song yet again, Concrete and Clay by Unit 4 Plus 2, 1965. And we played that because we're talking about Portland cement, invented closer to home than you might think. If you just tuned in, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every week, and we should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Hello.
You're sounding well, Paul. Are you fighting fit?
Yeah, fighting, I don't know about fit.
Oh, blimey. Well, there was a lot of stuff going around at the end of last year.
There certainly was, and I kept catching it.
Oh, yeah, I bumped into one of our neighbours walking his dogs, and I said, oh, have you had a nice Christmas, Dave? And he went, well, there's been a lot of illness in our house. And I went, oh, like norovirus. And he went, well, I'm not sure, actually. But I think there was a combination of flu, maybe bits of COVID. There's something else going around, a bit of norovirus as well.
I think my niece came in and told me that there's walking pneumonia.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, one of the things that was doing the rounds, which is, I think, a flavour of what I got. But hopefully I'm on the mend, so...
Excellent.
I saw, looking in the news this week, and I don't know if you spotted the thing from President-elect Trump sending to Keir Starmer to say, why don't you dismantle all of those windmills in the North Sea and get the fossil fuel oil out of the ground? Apparently because one of the American-based oil companies, Apache, I think it is, have decided that they're going to not pursue North Sea exploration anymore because it's too expensive to do. I think he's said for America that he's going to pump the oil out of the ground and keep going with that and make America totally self-sufficient on those things. So that's the kind of thinking that might be hanging around. So I was sort of looking at that, and then I caught a development from Sheffield University. And so middle of December, they published a report about new housing developments failing to protect wildlife. So they did a survey of new housing developments and found that developers are installing only half of the legally binding ecological features that they have to do to protect wildlife. So this is called the Lost Nature Report, written by researchers at the university, published by Wild Justice. And the survey was nearly 6,000 houses across 42 developments, found only half the promises to mitigate the harm to nature were kept. So many of the ecological enhancements are not being provided, with 83% of hedgehog highways, 100% of bug boxes, 75% of both bat and bird boxes were found to be missing from new home developments. The delivery of plant life to the sites was also lacking, with 39% of the trees detailed on the planting plans were missing or dead, and nearly half of the native hedges that were supposed to be laid did not exist. So I sort of caught my attention a bit, and I thought, like, well, it's very interesting, and if you want to know a bit more about that, you can go to sheffield.fc.uk and have a look for the article in the latest news. Professor Malcolm Tate from the University of Sheffield School of Geography and Planning said the government's announced ambitious housing targets on the assumption that the planning system can ensure harms to nature are mitigated. But our research shows that house builders aren't implementing the ecological enhancement that help nature that they've promised. So, a bit disturbing. You can get a full copy of the report or a summarised version from that website. It's also available from www.planningfornature.org if you want to find it. So I thought, well, okay, but one of the things I'm going to talk about is the things that we are looking to possibly do to better look after the climate. That's looking after nature, and I guess we're torn between a couple of things. I think National Grid just said it's going to scrap a £17.5 million pylon design, which looks fairly modern. It's not the old wired sort of cage box structure. It's a bit more like the tubes that the windmills are set on, with a little sort of Christmas tree bit on the top. But a lot of people, again, don't want to see that as an impact on the environment. they're proposing that something under the land would be better. But there's a massive cost implication. And I guess just in sort of contrast to what I've just been talking about, there's famously, towards the end of last year, the outcome of the Bat Tunnel on the HS2 line. It was proposed 3 years ago and at a cost of possibly £40 million. And this is, there are a couple of tunnels housing the HS2 lines and a couple of the, I think, Eastern lines that go through it. So they're building a concrete inner tunnel with a tunnel above that, which is the bat highway, so that this rare species of bats can fly through it. But like a lot of things, that started off estimated at 40 million and has ended out in excess of 100 million pounds to
yes.
provide that. So I guess we've got to kind of decide what we want. And the problem is one size doesn't fit all.
No,
so,
it's an interesting challenge going on about the pylons. And,
yeah.
you know, if you think about a place like Lanzarote, who had Cesare Manrique be very, controlling about what could be built on that island, he
yeah.
made sure everything was a certain height, but there's no pylons, there's no advertising boards, everything's
yeah.
underground. You know, everything,
yeah.
all the stuff is underground. And that's quite phenomenal. I don't know if there's anywhere else in the world that has done that.
Well, there are different commitments around the world, depending on what people see. And I guess on the finance side of things, of what certain societies and countries can afford. So it's really, I think, something that we've got to look at. There is a fundamental challenge, as I say, from somebody like Donald Trump, who believes that fossil fuels should be maxed, basically, and other people should carry the consequences, because the richer countries shouldn't be suffering. And we've got kind of an indication again in Europe that Ukraine is shutting down the Russian gas pipelines that run through Ukraine. They gave a year's notice. That's about to come about. And that has an impact on energy. And I think in difficult times, people really start to question decisions. Tactically, I guess, Putin decided that he'd get Europe dependent on cheap Russian gas, and it's going to be painful to move away from that. So, anyway.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one, because last year we talked about the crown, you know,
yeah.
King Charles, they own all the sea beds around the UK, or at least around England, and that's why he's got this vision to build offshore wind farms that people aren't keen on.
Yep.
But what's the alternative then? He wants us to be independent, and I guess.
Yeah, well, I think an interesting article in the iPaper from Tom Bowden. Are talking about Britain's big battle against climate change has to start here. So basically, he's looking at what we've got, saying that cycling and walking should be developed and made much easier in all parts of the country under an integrated transport strategy.
Oh, I feel like I've gone back to Yes Minister in 1970. There's an episode, there is an episode about integrated transport strategy. And yes. they're saying the same things then as they were or they are now. You know, we're transport plans by background, and of course, walking and cycling more. And public transport is a great thing, but you've got to have the strong policy base from your government,
yeah.
like it's done in other countries. We just have not followed that at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, again, we've got this problem that I think South Yorkshire Police were just saying they've impounded about 10 of these high-powered electric bikes that are more like a motorbike in style. And said that they're very dangerous. They can do 40 miles an
yeah.
hour. They're not licensed. I think we've seen lots of things from people like the fire brigade about the danger of the battery systems that are used in those kind of things. So cycling and walking, I guess, yeah, I know you guys are keen cyclists. I sort of don't cycle, I think, just because I have to get over a big hill to get out
yeah.
from home and
yeah.
get back
indeed.
Home. And there's no real sort of provision I guess an electric bike would do it, but then safety-wise, it's really difficult, I think, traversing Sheffield in a lot of ways. And an integrated transport system, it doesn't appear to be there. I mean, yeah, we're trying things like the Canadian roundabout that's just off Shalesmore.
Oh, yes. I think it's Dutch.
Yeah, Dutch.
But you know, it's a bit, well, from a cyclist's point of view, it's a bit of a from like too little, to be fair.
Yep.
You know, no cyclist really wants to be mixing with traffic if they can help it.
No, and the problem is, again, I think cost, because to separate, I mean, if you look at somewhere like Holland, they have a separate cycle lane alongside the main road. Even where the trams go, there's a separate lane for the cycles, with a sort of substantial curb usually to stop anything crossing over. So if we were to implement that here and try to do, we can't even sort of fix the potholes in the road.
But it's an interesting thing about Holland. You know, cyclists have a lot more rights over there. So if you step into a cycle lane as a pedestrian and get run over, then it's your fault.
Yeah.
So it's a double-edged sword, because actually, if you've got a lot of if everybody's cycling, you know, you're jostling for a space, and it's not, you know, there's a balance to be had, isn't there?
There is, and I think, like a lot of things where, you know, we tried a cycle scheme in Sheffield, and unfortunately, people abused it so badly.
The yellow bikes.
That was a great era, that.
You know, but you know what was really interesting about that? I know people stole the bikes and things, and we'd see people, you know, cycling around who probably hadn't got a lot of money. And it was like a new lease of life. They weren't have to pay for bus fares. They could put the stuff on in the basket and what have you. So in that respect, it just showed you that actually some people who couldn't afford a bike, if you gave them one, it could be transformational.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And the Wheels to Work scheme was one where you could get a bike, or you get a small motorbike or a moped. Or get some support to be able to get one of those, get you started off in life. So it's a matter of choices and a matter of cost, I think, a lot of the time. So, again, if we're looking at in the round, in this article, again, he puts forward that we're going to have to use heat pumps. And we've talked about heat pumps and said, yeah, they seem like a great idea. Again, on the reverse side of that, a lot of people have said that they're low efficiency in terms of the heat they generate. So you would have to get a bigger and bigger heat pump. There was talk about banning our gas boilers, so that would force you towards a heat pump, but they're between £10,000 and £20,000 installed. So, again, without something like a funding scheme, a government bank scheme, where you could spread the cost of that, what do you do? Again, because our energy prices are at such a height at the moment, would you want to amortise the debt of a heat pump across a number of years with your energy provider? I don't know. You know, it's one of those things.
It is an interesting, but things, you know, when we have Dr. Orgo Osmo on, because his background is air quality and mine to a certain degree as well, you know, these things don't happen overnight. It's a long-term change. The policies have to be there. But, you know, with heat pumps and all these things moving forward, there's some great things coming forward. But, you know, if for new builds, perhaps, but if you live in a 60s house or a 30s house, or, you know, everything else in your house is archaic, if you like, you know, compared to modern standards, it's very difficult to retrofit everything.
And we've got a problem again. You know, we're talking about pushing the planning system, which has impact on the original thing, talking about wildlife and everything else. But also, we've got some of the lowest housing standards in Europe. So, you know, we build things, but they're not particularly energy efficient. And what's our response been? Unfortunately, things like external cladding, and we've seen the disastrous effect of applying that to things. So I think it's got to be built into the system, and unfortunately, it tends to come with a cost. So, I say, because times are hard, then people find it's not quite as palatable. So, again, one of the other things that he brings forward is using smart tariffs. Well, to have smart tariffs at the moment, you've got to have a smart meter.
Oh, let's not get onto that, Paul.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've changed my supply to British Gas, who insisted that for their deal, I'd got to have smart meters installed. And they've been less than useless, from my point of view. In a building, my house is an old sort of property, and my electricity is in the cellar, and the meters are there, and it can't actually communicate back. So
like
I have
it,
to
Paul.
Manually read my meter.
So you don't spend all.
Go online to tell them how much to cane me for it.
It is an interesting one. But going back to that report by Sheffield University about the new housing report, the Lost Nature report,
yeah.
It's an interesting one because we were talking about modern housing and the way it's built, but also most modern housing now has got a very small piece of land to it. You know, historically, you could have ended up with quite a large piece of land, but now land's more valuable, I guess, and so they want to build as much on it as close together as possible, and invariably you've got no garden or tiny bit of garden and a hard standing or drive, and that's been a problem, you know, policy wise for lots of reasons, for even just water runoff.
No,
you know,
absolutely.
Everybody wants to park the car, and or they want to put artificial surfaces down or stone instead of having something that attracts nature. So it's not just about nature; it's about the climate as well, and how we deal with flooding. And you know, if everybody's got a hard standing, the water just runs off and goes somewhere else.
I think the thing is, again, a lot of new developments stick in a sewage system, which taps into the existing main sewage system, which again contributes to our problems, because when we've got a climatic change and lots of more rainfall, we're getting sewage spills here, there, everywhere. And if they don't spill on land, they spill out to sea. So it's something that's got to be managed. And I think that sort of looking at things, that, I mean, the thing for the future says that nature will look nicer because these things are implementing planting of various things, and the truth from that survey says, well, that's not happening most of the time. And what, sadly, I think one of my bugbears in recent times has been Fargate, which I know they've flagged to be completed. But if you look at the visualisations that they give you at the start of that, how soon are we going to see something that is the same as the visualisation? It's not, it changes. And I think, you know, although some areas are very good, what you find is there are conflict in interests. So outside the front of Midland Station, they put lots of lovely sort of stonework and stone benches, and then people decided that was a great place to have a skateboard park.
You can't win, can you? No.
We found that again up the top side of West Street.
Sadly, that's society, isn't it, as well? You know, we've all got our parts to play.
Yeah, it's the different demands, I say. And the problem is, you're looking for leadership that can do that. And it's it's really the razor's edge, I think, on a lot of things. So clear air, and that's something you guys are involved with work-wise, and they're saying that the air quality improvements will be significant, as they have been in recent decades. But fine particulate matter is still a major problem.
It is, yeah.
And CO2 production from traffic is still a problem. So I think electric vehicles is one of the things. Oh, we've got to get on board with electric vehicles. However, there are problems again. uses rare earths a lot, which cause potentially conflict. Looks like we might be shaping up to a trade war from America and China. And some of those things that will be holding us to ransom are things like the rare earths that are necessary for that technology. So, again...
As long as people have got the rare earth metals to use in the mobile phones and stuff, we won't be too worried, will we?
Well,
you know, it's what people value, isn't it?
It is. And I think, rather than completely electric, has been a pushback for hybridised vehicles.
Yes, best of both worlds, yeah, indeed. Yeah,
so it's really, that and the impact on work, on jobs. I mean, we've had at some length, I think, about artificial intelligence impacts and the sort of future of that. Again, it frees people up to have spare time, but it doesn't actually pay for them to live.
I'm sure there's a new term in the Oxford Dictionary called brain rot or something.
Perpetual
scrolling or something. But anyway, we are fast coming to the end of the Life Science Radio Show, Paul. Paul, you need your own show. You've done a sterling job.
Wow.
But just on a final note, you said about this report in the iPaper saying about Britain's battle with climate change has to start in Britain. It has to start. We can't just leave it all to the policymakers and everything like that. It's down to individuals, and we can all make small changes ourselves in our own lives, and that collectively can make a massive difference.
We can, and I'll give you an instance of it. I mean, we found out that the brand of tea bags that we were using had small plastic particles.
No.
It was a nice cup of tea, but it was dangerous. And I'd just bought a few boxes into stock. So we spent a very happy hour snipping tea bags, pouring out.
Amazing. But ever since we did that thing about you couldn't recycle certain tea bags...
Yeah.
I think it's improved now. You bought us a teapot and some loose leaf tea, and to this day we still only drink loose leaf tea.
Yeah,
you see,
I think and we've got it. And as I say, just again for convenience, I've been buying tea bags. I can buy the same tea as loose leaf tea, and we're back to using the teapot.
Amazing, brilliant! So, you see how things go around and come around.
Yeah, I think do the bits that you can.
Exactly.
Hopefully we'll get some of the bigger things sorted out with technology.
Excellent. What a great start to the new year, Paul. All good stuff. We'll speak to you on Monday on the Life Science... on Glory Days Rock Show, Monday 1 till 3. Excellent. We've just got a bit of time for a little bit of Future Times by Yes.
Yes.
We might be playing this on Glory Days soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Paul.
Cheers. Bye. Bye, guys.